Should Australia have a Charter of Rights? We already have a Human Rights Act in the ACT and a Charter of Rights and Responsibilities in Victoria. And inquiries in Tasmania and Western Australia have come down in favour of having their own Charter of Rights in those states. The man who chaired the Victorian inquiry and was special consultant to the West Australian one was Professor George Williams. And here he explains why he believes Australia should have its own national Charter of Rights and Responsibilities.
Well, thanks very much for the chance to talk to you today. And I should say it's a real pleasure to be here, but also it's a pleasure to be here as a new member of Civil Liberties Australia, and I'm really glad to be able to support what the organisation is doing. And being here for the AGM, it's certainly very impressive, the range of organisations that it can handle on such a small budget, but with such a dedicated staff. What I'll be doing is really starting at the beginning of this talk. I don't want to assume anything about Charters of Rights, and what I want to do is start from the beginning about whether indeed we need to make a change, to work through what the change would look like, how it would work, and then finally to actually get to the nitty-gritty for people who work in an organisation like this. How can you make a difference? How can you get involved in a strategic way with where the debate is right now? What can bodies like CLA actually do? With that in mind, I'm going to deal with three questions. Firstly, do we need law reform to better protect human rights in Australia? Secondly, what is the Charter of Rights and how, in my view, can it help in dealing with the problems we've got? And thirdly, how can we act to actually bring about a Charter of Rights in Australia today? And in around the 30 minutes I'll speak, I'm certainly happy to leave a bit for questions afterwards, so please save anything for that if you'd like me to explore further. Starting with that first question, do we actually need law reform? Is the law in good enough shape as it is today to adequately protect human rights? There's really two different ways this is looked at in Australia today. The first way is everything is fine. We do not need better legal protection. John Howard, as Prime Minister, put this in 2000 when he was asked on ABC Radio's AM program, what is the state of human rights protection in Australia today? And he described our reputation and our protection as being quite magnificent. And look, I have to say that in the main, I mean, I'll start a little controversy here, in the main he's correct, I'm going to say. In the main he is correct. I think we do need to take account of the fact that there are a lot of strengths in our system of government. We do have an open and largely free democracy. We've got a system where we've got independent courts and we have judges that are not corrupt, as opposed to many other countries in the world. We do have, in the main, a good system of laws. So I want to start from the point of view that in recognising that even though there are very serious and large problems, compared to many other nations, we do have a very solid base, and that actually does make it possible, I think, to have a far more effective charter than we might otherwise have. But certainly my view is that it's not correct today to describe our human rights protections as quite magnificent. It's simply false as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. And it can be illustrated in many different ways, perhaps through looking through the eyes of some of the most vulnerable, the most dispossessed in our community, and asking them directly about the protection of their human rights. People suffering a mental illness, people who are homeless, Indigenous peoples. Or looking through the myriad of examples that have come up in the last 10 to 15 years that illustrate that we do have a range of problems that need to be explored, and in fact are legal problems that need a legal response. And what I'll start by doing is just reminding you of a few of those problems that, in part, it's very easy to forget as we move into a new government. As it's already been suggested, the architecture that led to these problems is still in place. Indeed, some of these issues are still continuing in a very direct way, such as with regard to our anti-terror laws. And as yet, the new government has made no progress on a variety of these, not all of them, but on a variety of these to actually fix them. The first problem, which fortunately we have had some progress in, is the issue of children in detention. This is a legal problem, apart from the obvious moral, ethical and other problems. We're dealing here with the detention of hundreds of children, many of them unaccompanied, in circumstances whereby they suffered in large numbers mental illness. And I think we need to remind ourselves that as a nation we did lock up young children in circumstances where many of them became mentally ill. Now that's just abhorrent to Australians generally. It's something a lot of people didn't know about for a long time, but it took a long time to get the children out of detention. But in doing so, we have not yet dealt with the legal apparatus that enabled them to be detained in the first place. It remains very possible for that to be put back in place, whether it be in Nauru or in Australia, and we have a legal situation which remains to this day. What a lot of you won't know is, in fact, this legal mechanism went to the High Court. It was tested to determine whether the courts would allow children to be detained. And there were three High Court cases in 2004 which dealt directly with this issue. The first case in 2004 was called Woolley. And in that case, the High Court was asked, is it legal for the government to detain young children of any age in these detention camps? And the High Court unanimously said, yes, it is legal to detain children, incarcerate them in these or other circumstances. The second case in Barroos asked, well, once we know it's legal to detain them, can they be detained even if the circumstances are harsh or inhumane? And in that case, again, the High Court answered, not only can children be held, they can continue to be held even if the circumstances are harsh or inhumane. The third case in 2004 was Alcatel, where in that case they asked, how long can the children or other detainees be held for? And in that case, the High Court answered by a majority of 4-3, they can be held indefinitely, without charge, without trial, until the government decides that they can be released. Now, if you put those three things together, this is the bedrock of our legal system being determined by the High Court. It has applications in many, many other areas, in terror or other contexts. Just a couple of years ago, the High Court determined that we can, in this country, detain children of any age, indefinitely, including in circumstances that we regard as the most harsh and inhumane circumstances. And the High Court said it does not matter how bad the circumstances are, they have no legal rights to release, they have no legal rights to education, they have no legal rights to healthcare, or indeed no legal rights to any of the civilised things that we would expect anyone, let alone children, should have. Now, that's the legal basis upon which that could occur, and that's one of the examples I've got where not only is the Act still in place, but the potential for this to happen remains to be better or worse than what we've had in recent years. The second example relates to freedom of speech. And you might know that the big media organisations have had a Right to Know coalition formed because they're so concerned about suppression orders, about their inability to report the terror trials. And a lot of people don't know a lot of the trials that have been going on because they can't be reported. But what we've got is a really serious problem in this country that's led us ranked very low in the press freedom indexes because of the inability of the media to properly report what government is doing, including in circumstances where government itself might be breaching the law. And that's one of the most remarkable aspects of our free speech problem, that even if the government does something that should absolutely clearly come to light, in some circumstances that cannot be reported. The free speech problem relates, for example, to Albert Langer. You might remember a couple of years ago, who ran the Tweedledee and Tweedledum campaign, put the major parties equal last on your ballot paper. Now, he was actually advocating something that was a valid vote. The Electoral Act said you are allowed to vote in that way. But the Electoral Act also said you can't tell anyone or advocate that people vote in that way. And if you tell anyone about that voting method by advocating it, you can potentially be jailed. Now, Abbott Langer essentially wanted to be jailed. He was a bit of a rat bag, I have to say. He wanted to go to jail. He picked this up. He went to the High Court and he lost the case on free speech grounds and he was jailed for 10 weeks for advocating a valid way of voting in our electoral system. Now, I might digress here for a moment because it wasn't the best run case I've ever seen. I was actually in the High Court that day and actually offered to represent him for free because I felt he wasn't going to do a very good job. I was absolutely correct about that. He turned up in court. He doesn't have a law degree. He was unrepresented. He did have an instructing solicitor who had a badge that announced he'd talk for Prime Minister. He was just there to annoy the court and basically to go to jail. But his first argument was he looked up at Chief Justice Brennan on the court and he said, Chief Justice Brennan, my argument is I can make these points. The Electoral Act is invalid. It's unconstitutional. Therefore, the whole of the last election was unconstitutional. The government that won that election appointed you. You're unconstitutional. You have to go. And it was truly the most ineffective opening argument. Nonetheless, very entertaining at the time. He lost that case. The point is, he lost the case and went to jail for telling people about a method of voting that was legal in our system. And it's just amazing, even in electoral terms, people can't be told everything they need to know, advocated or otherwise, about our system. We've also got a real problem in this country about censorship. We are banning books, again, in this country, something we thought was from the 60s and 70s. Three books were banned just in the last year or so. The University of Melbourne Libraries had to take books off its shelves. They can no longer be studied because they are books that relate to terrorism. Two of the books are instruction manuals or advocacy tools relating to the conflict in the early 80s in Afghanistan, and they were used at the University of Melbourne to pry into the causes of terrorism. Those two books have been banned. You can't even use them for academic purposes, and the courses had to be cancelled at the University of Melbourne. Now, what a counterproductive thing to do, to actually remove the ability to study the books so we can understand why people turn to extreme conduct. But that's an example of books that have been banned. Philip Nitschke's book on euthanasia has also been banned in the last 12 months. And whatever your views on euthanasia, it's a very serious step to say that people cannot access these type of books. The ridiculous thing is they're only banned in print form. If you want a copy, just Google them on the internet. So it's a ridiculous ban, but the fact that we are banning these books is of grave concern. The third free speech example is about Pauline Pantsdown. Now, you might remember Pauline Pantsdown a while ago with the Backdoor Man song about Pauline Hanson. It had the great line, "I'm a backdoor man, I'm a homosexual, I'm proud of it. I'm a backdoor man for the Ku Klux Klan with a very horrendous plan. I'm a very caring potato." A ridiculous compilation of things. Pauline Hanson took offence, she went to court, she got an injunction, and the song was banned. That was in 1997. It has never been played on radio since. If any radio station plays that song, the producers and other people at the radio station can be jailed for contempt of court. Now, that was the most requested song on Triple J that week. I mean, that's how popular it was. And in that week, it got so many requests that it became the fifth most requested song over the whole year. Now, that song can't be played on the radio in Australia. I mean, what do you think about the song is irrelevant? Why are we banning songs with a political message, particularly that appeal to young people? And why do people go to jail if they actually play a song like that on the radio today? And that's a free speech problem that relates at the very core to the sort of country in which we live. I'll turn here to anti-terror laws. And, of course, this is another architecture that's still in place. We have had no amendments to the anti-terror laws since the change of government. And not only that, no amendments have been flagged to the anti-terror laws. Prior to September 11, Australia had not one law federally that dealt with terrorism. Nothing. Terrorism was not mentioned. Now, I actually recognise that they did need to enact some laws. I support some of the anti-terror laws. But what happened is they went completely overboard. In the 5 years, 5 or 6 years of how government looked at the issue, they enacted 44 new anti-terror laws in Australia. It averages one every 7 weeks. And it's quite remarkable how many laws we enacted in this country compared to any other comparable nation. I hosted a conference last year with people from the UK, the US and elsewhere, and they were just stunned to look at our anti-terror regime, both at how far it goes and how much further it goes than some of their laws, but also just the sheer volume of it, the opportunistic nature that anti-terror laws assumed in the war against terror, and the politics that went with it. If you look at the sort of things it does, our laws, for example, have an offence where you can be jailed for up to 15 years for possessing a thing connected with terrorism. Now, that's an interesting offence because thing is not defined. And one of those examples where you're not quite sure what the limits are, but if you say possess something you've downloaded from the internet as an academic that explains an instruction manual, how to do something, or is about jihad, or you're studying, if you like, Muslim culture, that's a thing connected with terrorism. There are no exceptions for academic speech. Other offences reverse the onus of proof. Others target criminal types based upon association rather than your actions. That was something that had gone out of the law a long time ago. We've got control orders whereby people can potentially be subjected to house arrest, not after any trial, but based upon what they might do in the future. The Attorney General can close down courts, which is happening at the moment, with suppression orders. And in fact, in one of these cases, you won't be aware, not only were the proceedings suppressed in one of these trials, but the suppression order was suppressed. So in fact, the media organisation could not report the fact that the trial had been suppressed, and there could be no debate even about the suppression of the proceedings. And that's how far that one particular went. Then, of course, there's the ASIO regime, which is one clear example of something that goes further than any other democratic nation I'm aware of. And that is a regime for the detention in secret of non-suspects for up to a week for intelligence gathering purposes. Journalists, academics or others could be subjected to that. And once you are detained, it's illegal to tell anyone about it or to report aspects of it for 2 years afterwards. And there are no exceptions if there's been mistreatment, and no exceptions if ASIO has breached the law in the treatment. So in other words, if a journalist wants to write a story that ASIO has misused the power, the journalist can be jailed for 2 years for writing that story. And that's something I've spoken to many journalists about, who are very worried about reporting anything to do with ASIO for fear that they will trench upon this particular provision and be the subject of a prosecution. We've also got new white powers for the interception of phone calls, particularly directed at innocent people. And we've also got the sedition laws, which, again, is something that I certainly have thought were ancient history in this country, but we've reintroduced the idea of jailing people not for their actions but for their speech. 7 years merely for what you say through the sedition laws. And that's something I think that is a real problem. Now, I've stopped there with my catalogue, but it's really only touched the surface. I haven't even talked about Indigenous Australia here. I haven't talked about the reopening of the torture debate in this country. I haven't talked about the backsliding in this nation on the death penalty. And I have to say, a level of bipartisanship for the death penalty being applied to the Bali bombers. And I haven't even got into those areas. But my point is simply this. We have a system, and it's a legal system, which has been exposed as having deep-seated flaws when it comes to the protection of human rights. When it comes to some areas of fundamental importance to Australian democracy, to personal liberty, to freedom of speech, and to the protection of the most vulnerable in the community, like children, unaccompanied children. My point is this, and that is that we do have a human rights problem in this country. I started by recognising the strength of our system. It's not good enough, I think. We need to do better. We need to remedy those problems. And we need to recognise that some of the most seriously vulnerable in this country are vulnerable, and our legal system is not only not protecting them, it's leaving them open to opportunistic political action, and leaving them open to people at times of fear, grief, or whatever, will take steps for political or other reasons that go too far. The next thing I want to talk about then is why I support a charter, given that important starting point. And the essential reason I support a charter is because it's not just a matter of approaching all of these issues on a one-off basis. We clearly should do so. We need to fix the terror laws, fix juvenile detention. But we also need a deep-seated, systematic and structural change as to how our politicians, parliaments, courts and communities debate issues of human rights. We need a sea change in human rights that goes to our language, goes to the legitimacy of human rights conceptions, and is an overarching strategy that not only deals with the problems, but makes sure it's very hard for them to occur again. The way you deal with that in other countries is through a charter or bill of rights. Australia is the only democratic nation in the world without this type of instrument. Every other nation's got it, and in fact I've made a bit of an academic career. I get invited to countries around the world because they want to know what's it like living in the last country without a Bill of Rights. I mean, South Africa, Canada, US, New Zealand, around the world, because we're an oddity and we don't quite understand how just unusual we are here and how different we look. As in their eyes, why don't we have a modern system of government is the question that I'm often asked in these forums. By a charter, I do not mean anything like the US Bill of Rights. And I think we need quickly to put that to one side. I do not see that as a good model for this country. Much too much focused on courts, much too much about putting contentious issues like abortion into the courts, and I think it's a bad way to go forward. What I support is a model that's consistent with parliamentary sovereignty. It's based upon the United Kingdom Human Rights Act of 1998. It's what the ACT has got, it's what New Zealand has got, it's what Victoria most recently has got. It's an ordinary act of parliament, which means critically it can be changed. I think that's very important. This ought to be the start of a journey, not pretending we can get everything right in the future, for the future. It's a bit like the right to bear arms in the United States. Well, it's really hard to remove it. We need a system that enables these things to be changed over time. An ordinary act of parliament can be changed. The model focuses particularly on international civil and political rights. We start with things like speech, voting, and other matters we take for granted. We put them in the law and give them protection. The rights would apply to everyone. Without exception, not just citizens, it's everyone in Australia should be entitled to the protection of the rights. None of the rights are absolute. We recognise that each of them has to be balanced against other interests. To take the anti-terror context, I support a law, for example, that breaches the right to privacy, that in order to prevent an imminent attack, does search emails of suspects, does so in a controlled and rigorous way, and does so in a transparent way in terms of checking that the authorities are not going too far. And I support appropriate and adequate surveillance powers. That's an appropriate balancing of a right against the rights of others, the right to life, protection and security, and the like. So none of the rights are absolute, but they're only balanced where there's a demonstrable and clear justification for doing so. The other thing about the Charter, what it says is it can't be a core-focused model. The real focus is at the community level, through education, and in parliaments, and actually making laws in the first place. And what I'll do here is just give you a quick sense of how this works, if you like, as a bit of a flowchart in how laws are made. Normally, these type of instruments, like the US style, doesn't have much of an impact when policymakers sit down to draft or think about a new anti-terror law or an issue like asylum seekers. What the Charter does, on the other hand, is it says often the decisive and most important point you can make a difference is when policy is drafted at the first stage. In other words, prevent the problem emerging in the first place rather than leaving it to the end for something to get into the courts. The Charter sets down a series of guidelines, principles, that direct and guide policymakers in developing new policies and laws. And it's having a big impact, say, in Victoria at the moment, really with the development of the prison here in ACT. When new policies or laws go to Cabinet, they're accompanied by clear statements as to whether the Charter is breached or not breached, so that Cabinet has that information before it. It's well advised of any problems. Once it goes into Parliament, the government must make a statement as to whether the law complies with the Charter or not, in a transparent way. Now, that may look a little weak, but it's actually one of the most effective mechanisms because it puts the government to the test and ensures that the government must, if it wants to breach human rights, be absolutely clear about that. And it just doesn't happen because governments don't want to be seen as breaching human rights. A good example of where this would have made a difference is with the Northern Territory intervention last year. Now, a lot of people don't know that there's a little provision buried in the intervention legislation which says that if this legislation is inconsistent with the Racial Discrimination Act, it overrides the Racial Discrimination Act. In other words, if the intervention legislation is racially discriminatory, well, so and good. It just operates in that way. Now, that got hidden. I mean, virtually no one knew about it. The Charter mechanism would force the government to say, publicly, directly, in a way the media would not be able to miss, we know our legislation is racially discriminatory, we want to pass it anyway. And that would fundamentally alter the political debate. It certainly does in other countries. And if a government wants to go down that path, it must pay a high political price for undermining human rights. If the circumstances are right and it wants to do it, well, it pays the price and it does it. But it must pay a price, and that has an enormous impact on what actually occurs. It's also a role for a parliamentary committee to scrutinise the government actions and to look at the legislation. And once that's done, it has an enormous impact in terms of the quality of legislation passed and heading off problems in the first place. And that's really the engine room of the Charter. Get the law right in the first place, stop governments slipping things through that we don't know about, and put the government in a place where everything is geared towards it complying with human rights rather than rejecting them. The role of the courts is limited. They cannot strike down laws under the Charter. Now, I know some people would want them to be able to strike down laws, but it's not part of this model. What they can do is interpret laws to be consistent with human rights, and it means in a day-to-day sense, the courts have a role of ensuring that the rights, that the laws are human rights consistent. And that, again, has a big impact at the coalface of making a difference. If the courts say this law is bad, we can't interpret it to be compliant with human rights, they make a special declaration that sends the law back to Parliament to be looked at again. And again, it raises an enormous political issue to say this law is rotten, we can't fix it, Parliament must look at it again. Now again, that might look a little weak, but it's enormously effective. In the UK, they've had 14 of these send-backs to Parliament, and in every single case, Parliament has made the changes needed to fix the law, including in the most contentious aspects of their anti-terror legislation. They fixed their control order regime, they fixed their detention without trial regime, because the courts identified a problem, and when an authoritative, rational decision-maker says that, Parliament fixed it. And what it does is it, again, puts it back in the political process and leads to, if you like, political responsibility being assumed for the problem as well as the fix. Now, that's the model. That's the Charter model. I can go into the detail if you'd like, but that's essentially what I support. It's what now is being adopted in countries around the world and in Australia. It's also what the reports in WA and Tasmania have recommended for their systems, and it's what the new federal attorney, Rob McClelland, is considering for the national debate. The last thing I want to talk about is, well, if you support, firstly, the fact we need change in this country, and secondly, you think the law is a problem and we need a charter or something else that you might support, what can you actually do to bring it about? What steps can be done at the moment? The first thing I'd say is we have a window of opportunity that has not been opened for around 20 years to look at this issue, and that must not be forgotten. This is a generational opportunity, and it tends to work in that way. The last time a serious look was had at this issue was in the mid-1980s during the Hawke government, and we have not had the opportunity since. We've also got the fact that there's a lot of momentum on site at the moment, which means there's a good opportunity and why the window is open. And there's another key reason I think strategically we need to follow the charter path in addition to our other strategies. And that is, unfortunately, I do not see much joy for us on many of these individual battles with the federal government when it comes to anti-terror laws or some of the other individual concerns that I've spoken about. We'll get some changes at the margins, like sedition laws, but we are not, in my view, likely to get a holistic change to the anti-terror laws. I wish I was wrong, but I just can't see it with this government. The fact that they've done nothing initially, it's not even a priority, sends a very clear signal as to what sort of energy they'll be putting into it. That's one of the reasons I put a lot more of my energy into the charter debate, because that has the ability to fix some of the anti-terror problems, to rebalance the legal system, and if you like, to restructure the system in a way that will ultimately help us in the anti-terror laws fight. If you can't win on the specifics, go for a different structure, even though, of course, you would fight both battles. But another reason as part of this, I think I'd go for this window, is that we need to bring human rights centre stage in many of these debates. Human rights is still very peripheral in Parliament. It doesn't come up in debate, it doesn't come up in the courts, and a charter would realign that and actually make it important and meaningful in a way that it ought to be. What we've got in our favour at the moment is momentum, more than anything else. The ACT, Victoria, Tasmania and WA. We've got community organisations like Civil Liberties Australia, which have good memberships, which have really become large and, in many cases in other states, quite influential because of issues like anti-terror laws and asylum seekers. We've also got now the fact momentum of moving on from the Howard era, and all of that are a big advantage strategically for us. We've also got a lot of underlying popular support, and that ought not to be forgotten. The opinion polls consistently show that people support the idea of better legal protection for human rights. One poll in 97 was 72%. A poll taken just last year was 70%. And indeed, if you look at Victoria, it was up to 85% around the time of the charter being enacted. There's a good body of support that ranges in every poll I've seen in the last 25 years between 65 and 80% of the community support the idea of better protection for human rights in this way. But when you put all of this together, what really meshes it together is we have a commitment of the federal Labor government to look at this issue, and it is an election commitment. It's taken very seriously by the Rudd government, and I quote, they are committed to initiating a public inquiry about how best to recognise and protect the human rights and freedoms enjoyed by all Australia. So we've got momentum, we've got public support, and we have an election commitment for a public inquiry. And that's why the window's open at the moment, and that's why there is the option of actually this occurring in the next couple of years. Well, on that basis, what do we need to do? I'd suggest four things that we need to look at to actually get from where we are today with things in our favour to this actually occurring. I think the first thing we need is we need Rob McClellan, the Attorney General, to actually bring about that process that Labor has promised, a community-based process to consider fairly and genuinely the idea of a Charter of Rights. Now, I'm happy with a fair and genuine process because I believe that will lead to the outcome. The promise is so clear, the support is so clear, that like Victoria, Tasmania, the ACT and Western Australia, I believe an inquiry will likely to lead to that outcome. To get that, we need people to be writing to the Attorney-General and we need people to be engaging with the Attorney-General, as I know this organisation has done, to thank him for the promise, to hold the inquiry and to hold him to that commitment. Not only that, we need to ensure that the inquiry is fair and is genuine and is community-based. We don't want a parliamentary inquiry that will be subject to partisan politics. We want a community-based inquiry like other jurisdictions have had that will involve not just lawyers, but critically a lot of non-lawyers and community people, and that will give everyone a say on the issue. Now, the reason we need that is this is the vehicle that we can use to actually show tremendous community support for the change. I'd be saying that to be successful, that inquiry needs something like 6,000 to 8,000 positive submissions. I mean, an enormous number. More than any inquiry of its kind has ever had in Australian history. But it can be done through organisation, it can be done through effective support and engagement, and through organisations like this getting its members to make submissions. If we've got a process and we get those overwhelming submissions and we get the 70-80% support, that then provides the political base for the government to move forward with confidence and to do so by saying, we've been told by people they want it, we're going to respond to that demand. At the community level, of course, we need organisations like this continuing to be organised, generating submissions, importantly doing media work, where the human rights groups in general don't tend to do very well, I have to say. I'm not making any particular comment about this organisation, but around Australia, we've got a lot of no stuff in the media in the last 3 or 4 months, but very little there on the pro case. We also need coordination, and one of the things I'll be doing in Sydney in the next couple of weeks is actually setting up a round table of civil liberties organisations from around the country, and HERIOC and all the bodies engaged in these sort of areas, to talk about strategy, campaigning and coordination in this field, so that people can actually not trip over each other, but around the charter process can actually get involved, and certainly Civil Liberties Australia will be invited to that. The last thing in terms of recognising what we need to do is to recognise that this only happens when you've got a political champion. And even though we've got a model, we've got a community base, we've got public support, it doesn't matter unless you've got a minister that actually is prepared to take it forward. New South Wales is a classic case where they've got the same conditions, but the minister doesn't like the idea, so it goes nowhere. I mean, it needs political leadership, effective political leadership. We need to recognise we do have that person in the shape of Rob McClelland, at the moment the Attorney General, but we equally need to recognise that he needs our support. He is not, if you like, expressing a majority or clear consensus opinion within the caucus or within the Rudd Labor government. He's putting himself out and needs support through letters, media work and elsewhere. And if you like, the issue will rise or fall according to whether he can actually get it up. So things that this organisation does, not to support him politically, I don't mean in a partisan way at all, but to recognise that the path that he's on is a good one, through letter writing and other things, is a very positive thing that can be done, including letter writing to the Prime Minister and others to say that, you know, we really appreciate the fact that this issue has been put on the agenda and we're really looking forward to the opportunity to take it forward. At the moment, my assessment of where we are in the debate is this. I think that despite everything that's been done and the momentum, human rights groups are actually losing the debate at the moment. I think we're on a backward foot and I think at the moment we're not heading in the right direction. That's because when I talk to people within the ministry or advisors or others, they're constantly telling me about the massive letter-writing campaign the churches and others are doing to undermine the charter process. They've been sending letters in vast numbers to the Prime Minister and elsewhere, saying this is a terrible idea and we think it's really got to stop, don't hold the inquiry. And in fact, when I was up there just last week talking to someone within the Prime Minister's office, they were saying it looks as if the human rights organisations are interested but not that interested in this issue because we get so few letters from them as opposed to the hundreds of letters we get from church and other organisations. Now that matters. The letters that are written matter in terms of judging at a ministerial level the interest, the support, and that's why in my view, if you really want to get engaged with this, this is the time when you talk to politicians, you send emails, you provide support, because the battle started with the election last year. It's been going now for several months, and at the moment it's not a matter of waiting for the process, it's a matter firstly of guaranteeing the process. And that was probably going to happen in the first half of the year. It's already been put off at least until the second half of the year because of genuine concerns about whether human rights groups will be supportive enough of the process. So I suppose I end on the point that everything suggests that we do need this. Everything suggests it can be done. But equally, we need to recognise this is a once in a 20-year opportunity. The battle has started, and I'd encourage you to get involved. This is an issue for citizens to get involved in. And I encourage you to take a stand, get involved, and I think organisations like this are in a powerful position to play a leadership role. Thank you. Look, I'm happy to take questions if you like. Yes?
Just a question on your last point about the church's writing in. They are at the forefront of the fight for refugee rights. How come they're against the whole basis of it in this Charter of Rights? It seems a complete bad face.
It is, and the churches are split on it. Certainly not groups like the Catholic Social Justice Commission, Uniting Church or others, but there is particularly the the very, the more extreme, about evangelical elements that get involved. They have quite large memberships. And, you know, thank you very much. They may only have a membership of 300, some of the more extreme churches, but if every one of those 300 people writes a letter, that's all letters. I'd also have to say that at some of the higher levels of some of the churches, to be frank, there is not support, even though they're concerned about refugees, there is not support for better protecting human rights and the law.
What are the church's arguments?
The church's arguments often come down to the point of view that courts get too much power and things like that, which is a third thing on this model. That's the US Bill of Rights. They try and shift it to that. But they don't put their real argument. The real argument is this, and it makes a lot of sense from their point of view. Particularly the Catholic Church, but some others, do not support legal change to prevent discrimination, particularly on grounds like sexuality and other grounds, and they correctly identify something like a charter as increasing tolerance of opening up debate about removing discrimination, say, against same-sex unions, or removing discrimination in superannuation for same-sex couples. And they, it's not the charter so much, it's the general principle of removing discrimination. And they look at other countries like Canada, where again, I mean, it's true, there is a bit of a link between, once you, if you like, educate people about these issues, they tend to say, well, we should remove discrimination, and that's against the teachings and values of some of the churches.
It tends to be a narrow sexual morality.
That's the most important. Abortion also comes up as an issue. But that can be dealt with. And what's happened in all of the Australian models is there's a provision in each of them that simply says, this charter does not affect anything to do with the law of abortion. It's just put to one side completely because it's not an issue that can be properly resolved. People get too hot under the collar. There's not a clear majority on which way to go. So that can be excised, and it has been excised. But it's more just, you know, I mean, if you don't want a system that actually, say, removes all discrimination against same-sex couples, then, you know, you may be wise to oppose a charter, to be frank. Because in the end, this sort of change is consistent with removing that type of discrimination.
Hi, I'm in favour of a Charter of Rights and really enjoyed your speech, but I also heard Professor Allen speak at the Senate Occasional Lecture. And he made the point that if you have the reading down provision or the provision in a charter that would allow a court to interpret a legislation, piece of legislation, in a way that's consistent with the Charter of Rights, even if that meant giving a particular provision a different meaning or change meaning from what was intended by Parliament. And he questioned whether by allowing that we're really threatening a principle of rule of law that says that the Parliament should be able to pass laws democratically elected and there should be some certainty in that. And I think that that is sometimes a difficult argument to counter with a charter. I just wondered how you go about countering that.
Yeah, that's a good question. He probably mentioned the Gaten Mendoza case, I suspect. Yep, and that's really the high point he mentions. And let me go through that, because it is an important point. And I mean, that's where James does have some good arguments. But fortunately, they've been taken into account with the drafting in Australia. And the concern is essentially that even though courts can't strike down things, they can interpret things, and if you like, interpret them so radically that in the end, it ends up with something Parliament never intended. And that's the concern, that, you know, courts go too far. And the Gaten Mendoza case in the UK is the example it uses. But, I mean, it shows, I think, also the weaknesses of the argument, because that was a case where a British statute said that any couple living as husband and wife can get a particular benefit. That was the exact words of the legislation, a couple living as husband and wife. And the question for the court was, can a same-sex couple get that benefit? And what the court said in that case was that, well, the legislation doesn't say husband and wife, it says living as husband and wife. And a human rights compliant interpretation would be to say, well, yes, a man and a man can live as husband and wife in terms of the relationship they have, or a woman and a woman. So they said, we'll interpret the law to recognise that we remove discrimination from those couples, and in doing so, we'll take that approach. Now, for me, I can live with the idea that a court removes discrimination in that way by saying a same-sex couple can live as husband and wife. But, you know, it's a controversial one, but that's as far as it's gone. But even then, the way it's been dealt with here is quite simple. The UK provision says that the courts, so far as possible, shall interpret every law to be consistent with human rights. The drafting that I've done in Victoria and elsewhere changes that to say, so far as possible, but consistent with the intention of Parliament, human rights compliant interpretation shall be reached. Now, we've added a qualification in there to say that courts cannot go so radically far from Parliament's intention to rewrite the statute. So we've come within the UK approach. So we've just met Jim's consideration by putting words directly in, requiring to look at parliamentary intention. It does limit what the courts can do, and some people say, well, that's wrong, they should have a freer reign. But I'm comfortable with a bit narrower. I suppose it disappoints me with the argument, because he raises it all the time, but he doesn't recognise the drafting change, and which just fundamentally changes it. And there's a speech given recently by Chief Justice Spiegelman of the New South Wales Supreme Court, probably the next Chief Justice of the High Court, who went through all of this and said, well, the Australian approach is fundamentally different, because once you force recognition of parliamentary intent, well, it can't be ignored, and so you can't have the things that are being suggested as problems.
It seems to me that part of the campaign of looking to provide support would be to, where possible, try and counter some of the arguments against, rather than just stating support, but to try and reach that slightly deeper level of analysis to counter some of the arguments against.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, and I think that's where organisations get involved. I mean, I think the starting point, as I did today, is to explain why it's needed and why it's important. You've got to do that, and you need to identify there is a problem. We have a solution, and it's a good solution. But yes, you do need to defend in a rigorous way the model, and in an intellectually sound way. And I think you've also got to be a bit flexible, because if problems are identified, then you need to say, well, we'll look at solutions. And it's why I also favour the Ordinary Act of Parliament approach, because let's say we hadn't put this in, well, down the track we probably should have, and you could amend it to fix that. But you need a sophisticated strategy, I agree with you.
You'll be interested to know that Ernst Lohheim brought up an objection to that particular point yesterday.
Well, and I was going to go to Jim's talk, but I actually mind my son, who's two at home on Fridays, and he's a terrible heckler. I thought it'd be a bit rude, but I disagree with Jim. I've debated Jim many, many times, but my son heckling there may have given the wrong impression, so I just couldn't get there, unfortunately.
Helen Wallace, Dr. Wallace. What is the lawyer's attitude? Just speaking to lawyers over the years, quite a few seem to have taken Mr. Howard's line that our law at the moment is better, even. It can be that this could be an impediment to human rights. What are the legal organisations, the official ones, what's their attitude?
Well, it's changed, actually, and it's changed remarkably in the last 10 years. And I think the anti-terror laws has probably been the main reason for that. That lawyers, more than any other group, can see just how bad those anti-terror laws are. It comes to the detail in a lot of cases. And the Law Council of Australia, which represents every legal organisation in the country, has changed its policy to positively favour a charter of this kind. And the organisation in Australia which had most opposed the change was the New South Wales Bar Association, which actually put submissions in against a change in New South Wales about 5 or 6 years ago. They changed their policy last month. Mm. And their president is now out there saying, we've changed our view. You know, we thought everything was okay, but we recognised that our view was based upon a series of assumptions that things would not happen. They have happened. And we recognise, therefore, that, you know, as lawyers, that the legal system needs to positively protect things rather than just assuming it'll be okay. So there is not a legal organisation in the country, a legal organisation that does not support this change.
Michael, you've got your hand up.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that the case you mentioned earlier, I think that was not a unanimous decision of the House of Lords.
Yes.
So in terms of stability of interpretation of the law, I just think disagreements as to the correct interpretation of the law, that's a fact of life with the law. There's not necessarily any getting away from it.
Well, you get two lawyers and you get three opinions, by the way. You have to pay for each one. But no, look, you're right. And look, it's early days in this. I have to say that there's a lot more work to be done. And what actually happened with that is that's the high point. The judges often go a bit too far too early, and now they've wound it back anyway in the UK with redrafting to fix it. But yes, there was dissent on that for other judges who wouldn't have gone as far as that anyway.
Amen.
We've been talking about a charter of rights. I suppose my question relates to the rights.
Yep.
I understand that the ACT consultative process ended up recommending both the inclusion of economic, social and cultural, as well as civil and political rights under the model that you're proposing. are both economic, social, cultural, as well as civil and political rights included, and if not, why not?
Yeah, and let me start, I'll answer that. Let me also start just to remind me something of a language issue too. I mean, we are talking about charters of rights, and the language is really significant here. I mean, when I got involved in this, I deliberately sought to change the language from bills of rights to charters of rights. Partly because bills of rights is too strong a connotation with the United States. And it's very hard to say we want a bill of rights but not the US bill of rights because they're too similar in a way. But in terms of being canny about this, the language really does matter. And when you're dealing with people who don't know a lot about the area, and what I've found, I've been lucky enough to be involved in some of the polling that they do in a really political way, is when you ask people who know nothing about, do you want a bill of rights? It's usually about 55% say yes. When you say you want a charter of rights, they say, I don't know what it is, but it sounds good. 70-80%. And it's just one of those things. It's why I constantly use charter of rights, even though it's purely a semantic thing between charter and bill. But it's just to say nothing like the US. But on the question about which rights to include, personally, I would in favour not only including civil and political rights like voting and trial by jury. I would like to see rights included dealing with housing, education, health. As a lawyer, I think the argument for it is very strong. I think also, if you look where rights violations occur, they do occur often most dramatically in those type of areas. But I have to say that I don't think it's politically feasible at the moment to get that second set in, as much as I'd like to get it in. That's because comparable nations don't tend to have that second set. So you can't sort of point to the UK and say they've got it. And the absence of that makes it really hard to sell. And it makes it hard to sort of push it forward. And what I actually did in Victoria, because I chaired the process that led to their charter, was we included all of the civil and political, but we required the government to review it after 4 years with a view to including the other rights. So it says, let's get what we can now. Let's not be too greedy, because if we went for everything, we would have lost it, to be frank. We've got nothing. Let's go up what we can get. It's starting points in ordinary acts so it can be amended. Once in 4 years' time, people think this thing's working fine. Why don't we put those in? Well, at that point, it becomes far more manageable, and I'm hopeful that will happen. Indeed, one of the really positive things I see in the ACT is that government here is now thinking about economic, social and cultural rights because the Human Rights Act hasn't been the concern they've feared for it. So they can contemplate things that could have only occurred through the familiarisation that occurs with, the gentler stuff going in first. So staged process, go with what you can get, and then over time fight the battle to get more. That's the way I put it.
And that review in the ACT is next year, the 5-year review in 2009. So it'll probably happen in 2010.
Yeah.
If there are a Conservative government in the United Kingdom, do you think it would try and wind back the current government?
It's a very interesting question. And interestingly, the way it tends to go is it's not always, but usually progressive governments that bring this about. The first government in Australia that sought to enact a Charter of Rights was actually the Queensland National Country Party government in 1959. Yeah. And that was the first attempt. There have been a number of attempts by Conservative parties, particularly along the lines of liberalism or protecting rural rights and things like that. So it's not, it's not an easy ideological fit. And indeed, in the United States, the Republicans, of course, are just as attached to their Bill of Rights as the Democrats are. You can't find any gaps between them, even though strong differences in application. But what you do tend to find is that when these type of instruments first come in, they often are opposed by the conservative side of politics if they're in opposition. But there has never been any instance in any democratic nation ever where the conservatives, having won power at a future time, have ever removed it. So it's never happened, even despite initial opposition. And that's because once people get human rights protection, they don't take happily to it being removed. And, at the moment, the state of play is Australians assume we have the protection. In fact, a poll last year found 61% of Australians think we have a Charter of Rights at the national level. And that's how bad it is. 61% think we've already got it. In fact, if you ask those people, should we remove the Charter of Rights you think we've got, they'd vote against you, perhaps, for removing something they don't have. It's just not a saleable argument. And it's interesting, the ACT is a classic example of what's happened around the world. Stefaniak and the leadership opposed it. We're going to repeal it. We've now got ZSLD who said, no way, I'm a human rights compliant leader. I'm going to keep the thing. The UK's had exactly the same, with the new opposition leader there now saying there's no way we'll repeal the Human Rights Act. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to strengthen it. We might replace it with a British Bill of Rights, which will have far stronger protections, be constitutionally entrenched. We may even let it overrule legislation. So we're trying to outflank the Brown government by going further along that path, because in the end he can see some options there that It's just it crosses all political bounds. The human rights argument is done well, and when you've got a base of 65 to 80%, it's a centre issue when it's done properly. So I think it's inconceivable they'll move away from some sort of protection, though the Conservatives may get a stronger one.
Are there any more questions? No, Ernst. Yeah.
Sorry to come in late, George, but just on that last point, we used to think it was inconceivable that any government would act to override the Racial Discrimination Act.
Yes.
But the last government did so on two occasions, yes, in 1998 in relation to the amendments to the Native Title Act, and last year in relation to the Northern Territory intervention, whereas we thought that racial discrimination was so entrenched that nobody would ever think of acting against it.
People don't know that that's happened. Yeah, you're right. Sorry, Ernst. Well, I mean, maybe I'll take that a little further, because I think what the question you could ask is, well, wouldn't you sort of undermine the human rights and the Charter in the same way the Racial Discrimination Act has happened? But I think the big difference with the Charter is that you can't muck around with human rights except by being explicit upfront and by putting a clear statement forward. Both of the amendments to the Racial Discrimination Act, through overriding, occurred in ways that the public didn't know about and got zip media attention at any note. And it could only happen because people didn't know about it. One of the main virtues of the Charter is not the legal stuff, it's just the fact that it changes the dynamics of the political debate by actually bringing human rights up to a level that people will not countenance that type of thing because they know about it, the media jumps on it, groups like this get involved in the debate because it's put up as a core value of our democracy. And again, that's a difference with other countries, that once things become publicly transparent, it's not the courts that interest me as the protectors. They're often too late, too expensive, too ineffective. It's how you prevent things occurring in the first place and prevent Parliament, through sleight of hand, making amendments to the Racial Discrimination Act or breaching rights that we only find out about some years down the track. So that's how I see the difference, if you like, that it's a structural difference that has an enormous impact upon the way that debate actually occurs through mandating transparency and mandating being upfront and honest.
I'd agree with that, because you've already got precedent in the Cabinet Commission told that they have an environmental impact statement,
yeah,
rather than a human rights impact statement.
Yeah. Mm. No, it happens in other countries, and it's I agree, it's sensible.
Surely you could have a police powers legislation at some stage that said that police powers have effect notwithstanding the human rights charter.
You could do so.
I think they did, rather than pulling back the whole of the human rights legislation.
You could, but you'd still need a state of compatibility to go in, whereby, it would say, the government introduces this Police Powers Act knowing, and you'd be required to say, breaches free speech, it breaches this, it breaches that. And look, yes, you could do that, but you'd be put to the political test in a far more significant way than doing it bearing in a section, 271B, in the Amending Act that you never find out about.
Adjuna, last question.
My question was just related to the previous question. And I guess do you feel that political protection in itself is enough in light, say, for example, the political surroundings around, after the September 11 attack? We were in such a sort of a political flurry that you could almost say, governments could justify politically, breaching civil rights. And I think, which is what they've done. And do you think that just having that political protection will be sufficient?
Well, I suppose what I would say is that no matter what sort of charter Bill of Rights we have, it's not perfect. There is no. I mean, it's just a bit of paper when it comes down to it. A useful tool, it gives us all sorts of things that are worthwhile having. But when you have something like September 11, you've got the US with one of the strongest forms in the world, look what happens. All sorts of awful things, including Guantanamo Bay. And I wouldn't want to kid you. I think that even if we get a charter or a Bill of Rights, it's a really good thing to do, but it is not a replacement for vigilance and political activism.
Yeah.
It enhances the capacity for vigilance and political activism. And for me, the real battle starts when you've got a charter of rights, the ability to use that to hold government to account, recognising that at the worst and most difficult times, it will be a frail shield. Because sometimes the pressures are so enormous within a political system when fear is involved, particularly, or grief, that good things go out the door. We forget our values, we forget our principles, we forget what we're about. So I agree with the tenor of your question. And I have to say, as a lawyer, I can't design you anything that will be helpful in the absence of activism or vigilance. I can just say it'll be better than it would otherwise be.
Malcolm, did you have a question?
US citizens presumably stand to defend their Bill of Rights. You tended to dismiss it. We had some strong arguments, I acknowledge. But Presumably the US citizens would think it highly important that the Congress not be able to override the bill. And also I would have thought there's a public ownership of a process. Well, there would be an our corresponding system, I suppose, because you need a referendum.
Yeah.
And there'd have to be everything debated. People would own them. I just wonder if you considered a variant of your model which has some basic kind of Bill of Rights or a referendum, constitutional change, but allowing the flexibility that you argued strongly, you also need for particulars to be added or amended.
Look, you can, and I have thought about this, you can have a bit of a hybrid, and I, for example, support putting in the Constitution a freedom from racial discrimination. I mean, it's an example of a particular right, and I do that because the Constitution is littered still with potentially racially discriminatory provisions, and the racist power is still there. It enables the federal parliament to make laws that discriminate against people on the basis of race. It was put there for that purpose in 1901. So you actually need a referendum to fix that, and when you're fixing it, you should reverse it to require only, you know, positive treatment. So I would be happy with, you know, odd changes like that. And in the longer term, perhaps have a charter work for 20 years, maybe that would be the outcome. I mean, Canada's a good example. They got their statutory charter in 1960. They put it in their constitution in 1982. But it couldn't have happened in 1960. You know, it took a generation for people to feel it works fine, we can live with it, it is ours, let's now take the next step. But they couldn't have got there by jumping, you know, to that final step. So yes, you can do that, but I think unless we take sort of a longer term view, get what we can get, and also recognise the need for education and engagement, which takes a long time to do, if we put this to a referendum, we'll lose.
Yeah.
You know, even the 60-85%. The last referendum we put on this issue was in 1988 by the Hawke government, which is some really innocuous proposals about extending existing protections about religious freedom to the states. It got 30% yes vote, the lowest yes vote in the history of referendums in this country, the lowest of all the 44 we've had. Even though most people thought it was a good idea, it just was unsellable without the education and processes that went with it. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I suppose I just say, you know, you stagger it and pick your fights.
Does that pragmatic line of yours outweigh the principles?
No, it's a good question, because it's not just pragmatism. I'd have to say that in a really principled way, I prefer the charter in any event. I do not think, even if we could say a referendum would pass, I do not believe putting a US-style Bill of Rights referendum-based into our constitution is the right thing to do. Partly because once you put it there, it is set in stone. And I do not think, even me, you know, and I think about these things and write about, I couldn't design you something that I'd be really confident that even for the next 50 years would be the right model. Partly because we have not had the community conversation, the politicians haven't been properly engaged, but we really have the confidence to do it now. And I'm really concerned about that I want something that, you know, in 50 years will be the best possible model, and that for me means it probably has to go through some big changes between now and then. But also, I don't want courts to strike down the laws. And I appear in the High Court regularly, and I tell you, I don't want the High Court deciding these matters. I do not want them having the final say. I do not trust them to make the best decisions in this area. High Court judges are political appointments, as all of these type of positions are, and I want them to have a role, but I don't want them to have the final say over issues like a same-sex marriage or whatever, partly because I don't think I'll get the outcome I want. You know, I'm not sure it'll be a human rights compliant outcome. But also because, you know, I'm a bit of a democrat in this sort of area. I think we should be debating these things in the community. I think if it's just court, you close down the debate. You know, there's people like me in court who argue it, but we need to have a big stoush in these things. And that's how you get people on side. People lose, but they accept the result because there's been a political process. And the courts don't do it. Indeed, one of the most disturbing things I saw in the US a couple of years ago was in the abortion debate, there was a march of 80,000 people about the US law on abortion. And I watched them going up the parade in Washington, and they weren't marching on Congress, they were marching on the US Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And that's really bad for the courts. It politicises them to too great an extent. But what can the courts do? It's impotent in terms of a march. I want the march on the Congress make their point known, not on the courts. It's got the system the wrong way around. So they're my principled arguments, I suppose. A range of perspectives, but maybe I'd have a different view, as I say, in the longer term. Mm. But I'm certainly not there yet.
Thank you, George.
Thank you.